We are in Boston at the Joslin Diabetes Center with Amy Wagers, who is a stem cell scientist here. She's also in the Department of Stem Cell and Regenerative Biology, Harvard Stem Cell Institute. And I should point out that we're in the midst of a bunch of hospitals here, children's hospitals, so mm-hmm. people might suddenly start hearing ambulances going by. But
it happens.
You work in, you're doing a meeting tomorrow, in fact, mm-hmm. on stem cell research in diabetes and metabolism. We're doing a stem cell meeting, as you know, this coming week, the fifth anniversary of CIRM, but we're also mm-hmm. talking to people for a future meeting, staying alive, diet, nutrition, metabolism, and aging. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this seems to be particularly appropriate at this point with an aging population, a boomer population, the realization that aging, you know, the metabolism plays a huge part mm-hmm. in the aging process, mm-hmm. and you're in the midst of this. I wonder if you could sort of start us off with a general sort of overview of that.
Yeah, so I mean, many fundamental processes in the body rely on metabolic function, and this changes as individuals age. This changes because body composition changes, because there are changes in the protein composition of cells. This interplay of the changes that are occurring in the body change fundamentally your ability to utilize energy and your ability to convert that productively into, you know, movement and these sorts of activities. And so this is something that this linkage between these processes of aging and metabolism go in both directions. So as individuals get older, there are metabolic dysregulations that accompany that process. Metabolic dysregulation early in life can be accompanied by changes in the body that might mirror changes that occur normally with aging. And so it's increasingly important to understand the interplay of those pathways.
Okay, now, here's the link that I need to have explained. The answer to the, we're talking about stem cells uh-huh. here, not eating better food.
Okay.
What's the link with stem cells? I mean, are we fixing people's bad dietary habits by giving them stem cells?
Right. No, certainly not. Certainly not. So another sort of normal or often common manifestation of aging is a loss of regenerative potential in tissues. So when you're young, you pull muscle, you repair that muscle quite well. You damage your muscle, you repair it quite well. Your blood system, which is a constantly regenerating tissue, knows exactly, you know, which types of cells it should make and in what combination. But as you age, those processes of regeneration and repair become dysregulated. And part of the signals that may contribute to the dysregulation of those stem cell populations come from metabolic signaling and the interplay between different tissues in the body that control metabolic regulation. So there's a important interplay there. And if we think about stem cell biology in a replacement setting, which is often how people think about using stem cells therapeutically, can you take a stem cell population and replace a tissue that's become damaged or deficient? Those stem cells are going to be responding to signals within the body, in the microenvironment of the body. And if you place them into a setting of altered metabolic function, that altered metabolic function can actually change the way those stem cells behave and the efficiency with which they can rebuild tissues. So having an appropriately regulated physiological system actually will, in the long run, enhance not only the resident regenerative potential of a body's tissues, but also the regenerative potential of cells that you might want to introduce to boost that repair.
So with all the talk now of regenerative medicine being mm-hmm. very specifically a direction that people are going in terms of therapeutic interventions, what can you do, what can be done in terms of stem cells where you have people with these kind of challenges?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think there are two ways that one can use stem cells for regenerative medicine. I think that the obvious one and the one that leaps immediately to mind in a lot of cases is transplantation, regeneration from a stem cell source that you introduce into the body. But I think another application of stem cells for regenerative medicine that may actually be sort of closer at hand is using those cells to screen for drugs that can be used to boost the endogenous repair potential of the body or to alter the environment or the metabolic phenotype of an individual. So in stem cells, you have the opportunity to generate target cell types that you might not otherwise have access to. And you can generate those in a culture dish in a laboratory. And you can study them, and you can study how they function and how their function can become dysregulated under certain physiologic conditions, like altered metabolic conditions, metabolic syndrome, aging. And you can then use that culture system to identify modes of intervention that you can then take from the culture into a living being in order to design new therapies. So I think those two approaches are really in parallel and also synergistic with one another.
Now, how does this fit together with the recent excitement following Yamanaka's work for iPS cells and so on?
Right. So this was breakthrough work because it now enables the generation of stem cell populations that are specific to particular diseases and that have the genetic components that give rise to those diseases. And from those stem cells, you can generate the cells that are the targets of disease. This is enormously important in diseases where those target cells are gone by the time you diagnose the disease, so you've never had them available to study. In rare disorders where the availability of cells to study may be very, very limited, and now you have the opportunity to generate them. Or in diseases that are very complex in their development or in their nature, and we don't understand all of the properties that make a cell a disease cell. And there may be huge variation from person to person in how the disease manifests. But now we can model all of that in these iPS cells that are derived from patients, differentiate them into the appropriate cells that we want to study, and compare across patients, across healthy controls, to try to get down to what are the genes and proteins that we need to manipulate to correct dysfunction in those cells.
Okay, now, a lot of your work was in blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of put that into context and also, as you go along, explain what this giant word hematopoietic means?
Yes. So hematopoietic simply means blood forming. The hematopoietic system sort of encompasses all of the cells that are circulating in your blood that provide carry oxygen to tissues, that provide blood clotting factors, that provide immune function and inflammation in the context of injury. All of these many different cell types coordinate to provide you with hematopoietic function in your system. So hematopoietic cells are key players in a number of different tissues. They communicate throughout the body, they travel in the circulation, they're present in all these tissues, and they can be regulatory in repair processes that are related to injury or infection. So these cells are central in a lot of different mechanisms.
And you work, is your work here involving that? Or?
Yeah, so my lab works on hematopoietic stem cells, which are the cells that originate all of the production of different blood cells. We study particularly how those cells are moving throughout the body and whether that movement has an important impact on their function. We also study how the function of those cells changes as animals age, because an interesting phenomenon in the aging hematopoietic system is that the stem cell population becomes sort of less able to produce blood cells, and it on occasion produces the wrong kind of blood cells. And so we're interested in how that happens, what changes are occurring with age that allow that alteration in differentiation potential and in regenerative potential, and whether those changes might be reversible, which would hopefully help to boost immune function and perhaps even delay certain types of blood cell cancers that are common in the elderly.
So I'm interested in this. Often these titles of papers are incomprehensible to lay people and so on, so I like to sort of unpack them for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's a paper here that you did with Tom Rando,
mm-hmm.
Rejuvenation of Aged Progenitor Cells by Exposure to a Young Systemic Environment.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So that was a very interesting study and a wonderful collaboration with Tom Rando at Stanford. In that study, we were interested in muscle regeneration and the fact that muscle regeneration, as one ages, becomes deficient, and how that's regulated. And there was reason to suspect that there was a regulatory axis coming from outside the muscle, from within the blood circulation. And so we set up a system where we could expose aged animals to a blood circulatory system that was more like a young animal. And when we did this, we had this really remarkable result, which was that an old animal, which normally couldn't repair a muscle injury, now, after having seen a young blood system for a period of weeks, was able to repair that injury. So that was the rejuvenation.
Could you just take me through that again more slowly? I mean, what are we actually physically talking about here?
As far as the how we expose the animals. So this is a model system known as parabiosis. It allows one to conjoin the blood system of two animals so that they share a common blood circulation. And this is an incredibly powerful technology because it allows the exchange of factors at normal physiologic levels rather than infusion of very high doses of cells or factors. You really get to see what the normal regulatory axis is in that system, and it allows a constant exposure. So we use that model system, and that's the parabiotic system, in order to look for rejuvenation, which was the restoration of repair function in the old individual that was involved in these. So what that means, why it's exciting, is that if we figure out the exact mechanisms by which this occurs, we can intervene through a systemic treatment. So we could deliver something to the bloodstream that would travel to the muscle and restore repair activity within the muscle. And this is something that becomes deficient in every individual as they age.
Right, now, so I don't want to sort of turn this into science fiction or leap too far, but it, just listening to that makes you think, oh, I need to get myself some young blood here. What are the practical?
Right. So, if we go back to what I was saying earlier about using stem cells as screening tools, the experiment really provides this proof in principle that the defects that arise with aging are reversible. That, as a fundamental, encourages then understanding or identifying those drugs that could reverse it. If you didn't know that it was reversible at all, you'd be less inclined to do those kinds of experiments. But we know that it's reversible, and we know something about the target cells that are involved. So now that gives us the impetus to go forward to identify culture-based assays that will mirror the defects we see with aging. They get reversed by a young systemic environment. And then we can use those screening tools to identify small molecules, drugs, that we can treat aged animals with and restore their potential for repair. And this is all now making use of the fact that we had this initial observation that it's possible, and that delivery in that method would be possible. So it doesn't necessarily mean, as you say, that there's something that is provided by the young animal that we couldn't get in any other way. And actually, as far as a therapeutic strategy, I think encouraging these kinds of drug discovery types of approaches in a lot of different systems, using stem cells is going to be quite powerful.
Yeah, I was talking earlier this afternoon to George Daly about the way information is communicated and how sometimes it's seized upon by media and given rather stronger billing than it should. I mean, you could almost, I'm surprised that somebody didn't say, Dracula scientist, find elixir of life or something. So, so the one of the important things that you mentioned here, and I'm looking now at a paper that you wrote in Nature Reviews Molecular Cell Biology with a SALT colleague, Leanne Jones, another stem cell biologist. Where you're talking about the stem cell niche and the importance of systemic influences, which is the phrase you were using in there as well. And I think it's sometimes missed certainly not with it to scientists themselves, but how complicated and complex the systems are that are governing a lot of these
right.
influences.
Right.
I wonder,
right.
Do you want to just elaborate and gloss this a little bit?
Right. Right. So what we mean by niche is a term that we steal from ecology, and it describes a particular environment that's supportive of functioning, in this case, of a stem cell. So the niche as a concept can be defined anatomically, so what's around a stem cell, and it can also be defined functionally, so what regulates a stem cell's activity. And so this would involve, so what's around a stem cell are other cells, non-stem cells, their daughters that they produce by division, proteins that are produced by the cells and secreted into the environment. These include signaling molecules that tell the cell, regulatory molecules,
right.
Adhesion molecules that stick the cell where it is and keep it there, or signals that say it's time to leave and migrate to a new location. This includes inputs from the from nerve cells, from the nervous system that communicate signals throughout the body, mm-hmm. as well as signals that come through the bloodstream, which,
right.
if you think about it, reaches all of the cells in your body in some way. So the systemic axis for regulating stem cells has sort of describes factors that circulate in the blood and that are delivered into this environment where they're able then to regulate, either to regulate the stem cells themselves directly or to regulate the cells that support the stem cells, and those regulatory signals then get communicated to the stem cell to determine the appropriate response in the stem cell compartment.
Yeah.
So any one of those areas can become dysfunctional in disease.
Just give me some clue about the way you got into this whole business and how you, I know going back a little bit that you certainly when I think of hematopoiesis, I think of Irv Weissman at
mm-hmm.
Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were obviously in Irv's lab at some point.
I was. I did my postdoc with Irv Weissman at Stanford.
But let's go back even before that and say, did you have parents who were scientists? I mean, how did you even think about science as an option?
My father was an engineer, but there were no biologists in my family. I wanted to be a biologist since I was 10 years old. I have no idea why. It always appealed to me. I always enjoyed it. It always excited me, and I was lucky to be encouraged by my family and encouraged by my teachers to keep pursuing that.
So you don't just sort of walk out and 10 years old and say, I want to be a biologist. I mean, most people don't even know what a biologist is. So was there something going on that sparked your interest at that point? Were you?
I don't know. I read a lot as a kid, and I was really interested in the natural world and in animals, animal behavior, these sorts of things. And I was also lucky enough to get into some early science programs at universities near where we lived and get some exposure to research. And my first research experiences were actually at Arizona State University, which is where I was a high school student. I had an independent project with a primatologist there.
This was as a school child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And getting a taste of what it was like to watch scientists at work and so on.
Right.
I mean, ASU, if you look on the Science Network's website, just a mm-hmm. little plug here, you'll see that we actually did work with Lawrence Krauss, who's the Origins Director, on this major Origins initiative that had at ASU recently.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great.
Which brought together people from all sorts of different disciplines. That's the whole function of the ASU
mm-hmm.
Idea is to knock down some of the silo walls between
mm-hmm.
the different disciplines.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
So you got a taste of what it was like, and that just sparked that just confirmed your interest, and you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how did you proceed from there?
So after that, I went to college and I sought out a lab for my job. And
you read biology?
I went to study biology, actually to study biology generally. By the end of my undergraduate experience, I specialized into immunology, but that didn't happen until my last year of college. So I sought out a lab to do research in, and I started as a glass washer, and I washed glassware and sort of watched what was going on, and slowly I was given a project, and I got to do science with my own hands and really enjoyed it and continued along that path.
I read somewhere that your particular interest in stem cell biology came from some interesting circumstances.
Yeah.
You want to tell me that story?
So I became interested in immunology when I was finishing my undergraduate, and I went to do graduate work at Northwestern in immunology, and I studied T cell trafficking.
Yeah.
And around the time that I was thinking about finishing up my PhD and looking for a postdoc, I got a call from my mom who said, I wouldn't normally forward this kind of thing, but it seemed important. And it was the National Marrow Donor Program, and they were trying to reach me because I'd matched with someone for a bone marrow transplant. This was a program that I had joined when I think the last week I was in college, and I was walking through the student union and they were doing a bone marrow drive. And you know, you donate a little bit of blood and you're in the registry. And they called me up and I talked to them, and we went through the process of doing matching, and it was looking really like we were going to go forward with this. I read a lot about bone marrow transplant, got really interested in it, learned about stem cells, and decided that was what I was going to do my postdoc on. In the end, the patient actually opted not to go forward with the transplant. There are still significant risks involved in transplantation, but I update my information in the registry every year to make sure that if that person is still out there, then they can find me.
Yeah. So your actual entree into stem cell work was at Stanford then, in the Weissman lab?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I started working on stem cells when I came to Irv Weissman's lab. I had done work, as I said, in immunology, trying to understand how the immune cells of the body moved around in the body and got to the right location to fight infection. And in reading about bone marrow transplant, I realized that one of the key aspects to bone marrow transplant is that while the stem cells normally reside in your bones, when you do a bone marrow transplant, you put those cells into the blood. And so they have to figure out how to get from the blood and back into the bone in order to regrow the blood system. And so I thought that was a really interesting question of how they did that. And I thought that my background in understanding how other cells of the blood system moved around would be helpful in answering that question. And so I went to Irv's lab to study that particular aspect of hematopoietic stem cells. Although after being in Irv's lab, my interest broadened, and in by the end of the time I was there, I was working half the time on skeletal muscle. This is the way I think that science goes. You follow your interests and you follow unexpected opportunities, I think, sometimes.
Which led, tell me about the little evidence of developmental plasticity of hematopoietic stem cells, because this was a shift.
Taking it from my perspective at the time, we had developed a number of different assays that were designed to help us track where blood stem cells moved in the body. These were the parabiosis assays, which I described earlier, and also the ability to transplant a single hematopoietic blood-forming stem cell and track its progeny. And so we had set up these assays, and this was around the time that there developed a lot of excitement around the idea that hematopoietic stem cells in the bone marrow might be able to make more than just blood cells, that they might actually be precursors to solid tissues like the skeletal muscle, or neurons in the brain, or liver cells. And so this was a really unexpected suggestion and an exciting possibility, because bone marrow transplants are performed quite often, and so we have a lot of experience with that. So we were really interested in looking more deeply into that idea. And so we used these systems, these single cell transplant and parabiosis systems, to try to track the fate of blood-forming stem cells after transplantation. And what we found when we did that is that blood stem cells are phenomenally good at making blood, but they really don't make other types of tissues. They can make differentiated cells of a particular type that happen to have a property that they have a higher propensity of fusing with other cell types. And when this happens, it can look like they have differentiated into a skeletal muscle fiber, for instance. But that's a different process to fuse into something than to differentiate into it.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the frequency with which this happens is extremely low, less than 0.01% of fibers in the muscle in our experiments. And so this kind of changed or I guess in some ways reverted the way we had thought about blood-forming stem cells, which is, as I said, that they are really precursors to the blood system, not precursors to all tissues in the body.
So the received wisdom at the time was that they had this giant potential repertoire, and you in fact said, no, the blood cells do blood. And they do blood really well.
They do blood very well. A single blood stem cell can reconstitute the entire blood system of an animal, which is a remarkable potential.
I guess I could ask him, do you remember what Irv said at the time?
I don't remember.
Oh, probably wise on your part. Tell me about this meeting that's going to be happening tomorrow. I mean, what are the important questions that you think will be raised, and the important directions to go in terms of diabetes and stem cells?
Right. So this meeting will touch on a number of very new and emerging ideas in diabetes and metabolism, and it will take into account new findings in both type 1 or juvenile onset diabetes, as well as in type 2 or adult onset metabolic syndrome associated diabetes.
Right.
And there's a number of important questions that I think will be addressed. One of the key ones is, how can we make new beta cells? These are the cell types that are lost in the process of diabetes, and these are the cells that make insulin, which is the important component for regulating glucose uptake. And so replacing that function is going to be essential in developing a cure for the disease. So I think that question will be central in a lot of our discussions. I think also the interplay between different types of tissues, and particularly the important role of adipose tissue or fat tissue in regulating metabolism, and the role or sort of the understanding of how that fat tissue is produced, how there are stem cells that regulate the production of that tissue, and how there's an interplay between those tissues and other tissues that regulate overall the body's ability to respond appropriately to insulin and glucose.
Do you take this information, this bench of information you have, and convert it into advice or even personal habits and so on? I mean, do you take it on board? Or
do I take this? I'm sorry, I missed your what? Which
do you,
information?
Do you follow your own investigative advice, in a sense?
That's an interesting question. The question is whether I do it more so than I would if I didn't
work in
this field.
Yeah, I'm thinking particularly about having a conversation with Cynthia Kenyon.
Right,
where
right.
She saw the effects of sugar on C. elegans and changed her diet instantly.
Right. You know, it's a tough question. I don't think incorporate those types of things into my life in a extreme way, but I'm sure that they play heavily into the way I live my life as far as exercise and thinking about what you eat. And I don't think I do the appropriate amount of controlling stress and getting enough rest, though. In some ways, I think it's incompatible with the scientific lifestyle.
Yeah. So the other thing I was talking to George Daly about earlier was about the communication of this kind of information to a general public, which I usually find is hungry for information.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me counterproductive when you have a bill, like a health bill, going through Congress, for there to be a lack of information for people to make informed decisions about their own lives and the kind of health system that will be supporting their existence. And the kind of work you're doing here, the kind of stem cell work, the work on diabetes and so on, the whole story about metabolic disorder and so on, finally I begin to see lots of stories appearing about metabolic syndrome and so on. But it's taken a while. It's taken a while to get this simple information about how we metabolize and so on. So. Any thoughts about communication of science?
Oh, I think communication of science is very important. I think it's a process, and I think that there needs to be a recognition that science is a living being. It's an evolving creature in many ways, and so what we understand today will be reinterpreted in the light of what we know 10 years from now. And so it's always important, I think, in communicating the information that we have to realize that what we understand now is what we understand in the context of what we know, and what we know is probably only a very small percentage of what we need to know. And so communicating the process, I think, of scientific discovery is something that maybe we haven't done as much of as scientists, and so that's something, you know, articles that come out and say, you know, we've discovered X, but in fact, that discovery raised 18 other questions that are essential to answer before we can really move to the next step. Whereas it seems sometimes to me what the desire is, as you're saying, for communicating information, is that what we should communicate is fact, and science is rarely that cut and dried when it's when the first discovery is made.
Well, there's a problem, isn't there? There's this sort of... if you're expecting deliverables, and that's what you allegedly are getting grants for from national institutes, which are funded by public money and so on, you're supposed to deliver something. Mm-hmm. And indeed, a lot of stuff is delivered. But on the other hand, as you were saying, as a process, science is a moving target. It's shifting all the time, things are changing, it's not clear that what's accurate today. And that's conversely destabilizing to people who are expecting deliverables, right?
Yes. I can see that, and I can sympathize with that. I think it's an important component of the discovery process is that you're allowed to question your previous conclusions, and you're in fact expected and encouraged to do so, because as you discover more, you only by questioning these paradigms of what happens can we make progress in many ways. So for many individuals, differentiation, so development of a adult cell, a skin cell, was an irreversible process until it was demonstrated by someone who said, well, is it really, by John Gurdon, that it wasn't, in fact, an irreversible process. And, you know, it was the same kind of questioning of established fact that led Shinya Yamanaka to generate iPS cells, which are now an enormously important component of biomedical research. And so I think it's really important to draw conclusions, but always to keep in mind that they're in context of what we know at the time, and that they should constantly be reevaluated.
This will be, as I said, next week is the fifth anniversary of Proposition 71, followed by the establishment of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, CIRM, 5 years. You went through that 5 years in the trenches, in front line. Mm-hmm. There's another 5 years ahead. Do you want to give me some sort of evaluation of what you think it was like, and what's been done, and what you see coming down the pike?
So I think it's been an enormously exciting 5 years for stem cell biology, and I think that it's been exciting on a number of levels. On the, you know, straight scientific level, the rate of discovery is incredibly rapid. You go to a scientific meeting every 3 months and you'll learn something new, and that's a really fantastic period to be in a field, to see it moving that quickly. I think it's been a wonderful 5 years in the sense of cross-cutting interdisciplinary communicative science. And it's something I've seen here particularly of in scientists collaborating between their institutions, between their laboratories, working on bigger problems than one laboratory can tackle on its own. And I think that's a process that I see expanding in the future, and I think that will move forward science at an even accelerated pace in the coming 5 years.
If you went into this at 10, this is unlikely that you thought about this, but I tend to ask people if they hadn't gone into science, is there anything else that was just a major passion that they would have loved to have done?
I always wanted to do this. I know, it's very boring. This is what I always wanted to do, and I feel incredibly lucky that I've had the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. What are you optimistic about?
I guess one thing that makes me optimistic is working with trainees and seeing the excitement and the quality of, I guess, rigor and investigative passion of the people that are in the next generation of science. And so knowing that very highly motivated, very smart people are coming to this field, and they were coming to it even when it was potentially a dangerous area to be in because there were regulatory issues and no one really knew how you were going to move forward, and still this field attracted really passionate, hardworking people. And so I'm optimistic that we'll continue on this trajectory.
One of the things that I find that the people who go into this business enjoy very much learning about is the history of science and how that all happened. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to ask people if they had a chance to go to a dinner party, as you're about to go to or now, and you could have anybody there from history,
yeah,
that you would really like to talk to and find out what they knew and get dig a little. Is there anybody that really just comes up on your radar and you think, God, I wish I had a chance to talk to them at dinner?
I hesitate to put this person into history, but one of the people that I've looked up to, that I've read about as a sort of role model to me in science, was Barbara McClintock, and so she's someone that I would really like to have a chance to talk to, just for a lot of reasons. I think an incredibly intuitive person, scientifically very creative, and also I think a role model for women in science.
Well. Perhaps sometime down the line, somebody will be saying something similar about you.
It's kind of you to say.
Amy Wages, thanks very much.
Thank you.